Kern was born in New York City in 1885, the same year as Edna Ferber, into a prosperous household. His father was a successful businessman, and young Jerome was well educated. He trained in musical theory and composition at the New York College of Music, though he spent his early years working in Tin Pan Alley. His original specialty was creating new songs for imported plays, interpolations as they were known in the trade, but soon he was cranking out original scores. Kern might never have become famous. He was booked to sail on the Lusitania in May 1915 on its last fateful voyage, but overslept. It was an extraordinarily busy time on Broadway. An average of 50 new musicals a year opened in the 1920s. Kern was amazingly prolific. In 1917 alone, he wrote the music for 5 plays and a number of incidental songs as well. But he also developed ambitions. In the same year, he wrote, "It is my opinion that the musical numbers should carry the action of the play and should be representative of the personalities of the characters who sing them." This was, improbable though it may seem today, a revolutionary notion, and it was Showboat that would make it a reality. Kern could do with a hit. He had already had one notable failure in 1927. Lucky had opened on March 22nd to mixed reviews and closed 2 months later, on the day Lindbergh landed in Paris. The play apparently had one wonderful song, Spring Is Here, but Kern neglected to get it published, and it is now lost. Of Kern's most recent 5 plays, just one, Sunny, had been a real hit. The others had mostly been disappointing. Dear Sir closed after just 15 performances, so Showboat was both a crucial production for him and a bold gamble, too. It had a complicated plot, it covered a span of 40 years, and it addressed the highly sensitive issue of race, not the obvious makings of a night of light-hearted entertainment. Showboat began rehearsals in the second week of September, almost 3 months ahead of its scheduled opening on Broadway, which was much, much earlier than would normally be the case. But its epic production numbers required careful preparation. With music by Kern, book and lyrics by Oscar Hammerstein II, choreography by Sammy Lee, and sets by Joseph Urban, Showboat debuted at the National Theatre in Washington on November 15th, then moved on to Philadelphia, and finally opened on Broadway at the new Ziegfeld Theatre on December 27th. Rio Rita, the play Charles Lindbergh never quite saw, had to move out to make room for it. The reception everywhere was ecstatic. As Lahr put it in 1993, nothing like it had ever been seen on the American stage. It marked the birth of the integrated musical, by which is meant simply that all the elements of a musical, script, songs, dance, sets, contributed to a coherent whole, exactly what Kern had been calling for as far back as 1917. Showboat was racy stuff in every sense of the word. It involved miscegenation and relations between blacks and whites, and dealt sympathetically with the plight of black people in the South. It had a chorus of 96 equally divided between blacks and whites, and was the first production in the history of American theater in which blacks and whites sang together on stage. Just 3 years earlier, when authorities learned that Eugene O'Neill's play All God's Chillen proposed to show black and white children playing together as if that were normal, the district attorney for Manhattan sent the police to stop it. So for that reason alone, the play was tremendously exciting. For people inclined to be enlightened, this was a breakout moment. The play contains 6 songs that are still widely known today: Old Man River, Can't Help Lovin' Dat Man, Bill, Make Believe, Why Do I Love You, and You Are Love. Old Man River turned out to be uncannily like an existing song called Long-Haired Mama, published earlier that year. The composer, Maury Madison, thought so too, and sued Kern. They settled out of court. The substance of the play itself was anything but an automatic hit. As well as miscegenation, it seriously looked at gambling and broken marriages. It was also extremely long, not finishing until after 11:30 p.m. But people flocked to it. Several members of the audience were moved literally to tears. From the beginning, Showboat was a smash hit, grossing $50,000 a week during the course of its run. It was a memorable week for Edna Ferber. The night after Showboat opened, a play she co-wrote with George S. Kaufman, The Royal Family, had its premiere. A comedy that deftly parodied the famously temperamental and self-important Barrymore acting clan, it was an immediate hit and ran for 10 months. The Barrymores were eminently worthy of parody. John Barrymore once left a stage to punch out an electrician who had not focused a light on him properly. And if someone coughed while he was emoting, he would stop and call out to the audience, "Would someone please throw that seal a fish?" Ethel Barrymore did her best to get the play stopped, but failed. Although Ferber and Kaufman squabbled endlessly and often bitterly, they wrote 3 great comedies together, The Royal Family, Dinner at 8, and Stage Door, before breaking up in permanent rancor. When Kaufman was near death, Ferber came to visit him and thought they had made a reconciliation. As she left, Kaufman called her back and said, "Edna, are you going to the funeral?" "What funeral?" she asked. "Yours! You're dead, Edna, dead!" he cried, and fell back on the pillows. He never spoke to her again. Altogether, 18 plays opened on Broadway in the week that Showboat premiered, 11 of them on the day after Christmas, making it the busiest single night in the history of Broadway. Theater seemed to be enjoying its greatest triumph, but in fact, this would turn out to be its last hurrah. Talking pictures were about to change the world of entertainment profoundly, not just by stealing audiences from live theater, but even worse, by stealing talent. Talking pictures needed actors who were comfortable with the spoken word, and writers who could create real dialogue. An enormous exodus was about to begin. Spencer Tracy, Clark Gable, Humphrey Bogart, Frederick March, Betty Davis, W.C. Fields, James Cagney, Claudette Colbert, Edward G. Robinson, Leslie Howard, Basil Rathbone, Claude Rains, Cary Grant, Paul Muni, Paulette Goddard, and many more who could be seen in 1927 on Broadway, would all shortly decamp to Hollywood. Most would never return. American theater would never be the same again. When Showboat went on the road in 1929, it didn't do very well at all. Everybody was at the talkies. Chapter 29. Of all the figures who rose to prominence in the 1920s in America, none had a more pugnacious manner, finer head of hair, or more memorable name than Kennesaw Mountain Landis. Landis was a slight figure. He weighed no more than 130 pounds and stood just 5.5 feet tall, but a commanding presence. 61 years old in the summer of 1927, he had a wizened face and parchment skin beneath a white mane. The radical journalist John Reed described Landis as having the face of Andrew Jackson 3 years dead. Born and raised in Millville, Ohio, he owed his curious name to a bizarre circumstance. His father, a surgeon for the Union Army in the Civil War, lost his leg at Kennesaw Mountain, Georgia, and, oddly, decided to commemorate the event by naming his son after the site. Landis trained as a lawyer in Chicago, then by chance and good fortune landed a plum job as personal assistant to Walter O. Gresham, U.S. Secretary of State under President Grover Cleveland. As a reward for diligent service to the nation, Landis was made a federal judge in Illinois in 1905. There he distinguished himself by his many rash and startling judgments. He gained national attention by charging Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany with murder after the sinking of the Lusitania, on the grounds that he had killed a resident of Illinois. In his most famous case, he fined Standard Oil $29 million, an audacious sum, for violating antitrust laws. Soon afterwards, an appeals court threw Landis's judgment out, which is what often happened with Landis decisions. According to one authority, Landis had more cases reversed on appeal than any other judge in the federal system. Wherever legal news was being made, Landis was uncannily present. He presided over the early stages of the famous libel suit between Henry Ford and the Chicago Tribune. The trial was then moved to Michigan, outside his jurisdiction. During and after the First World War, Landis became particularly noted for prosecuting radicals. He sentenced Victor Berger, a socialist congressman from Wisconsin, to 20 years in prison for criticizing the war in a newspaper editorial. Later, he said, he would far rather have stood Berger in front of a firing squad. That sentence was later overturned. He held a group trial for 101 members of the Industrial Workers of the World, who were collectively charged with 17,022 crimes. Despite the complexity of the case, under Landis's expert guidance, the jury took less than an hour to find every one of the defendants guilty. Landis dispensed total sentences of over 800 years and fines totaling $2.5 million, enough to finish the Industrial Workers of the World as a national force. In the same period, Landis took charge of an antitrust case between the existing major leagues and the upstart Federal League. For years, the American and National Leagues had enjoyed monopoly powers, which allowed them to impose a contractual submissiveness on players through the reserve clause. But the Federal League threatened all that by offering better pay and the chance of free agency. Landis permanently endeared himself to American and National League team owners by deferring a ruling for so long that the Federal League owners eventually ran out of money, gave up, and disbanded. With the Federal League out of the way, the baseball owners were able to return to treating their players appallingly. They renounced all agreements made during the Federal League's existence, refused to deal further with a new players' union, and cut salaries everywhere. All this created quite a lot of ill will among the players, and nowhere more so than on the Chicago White Sox, whose owner, Charles Comiskey, was famed for his miserly instincts. Comiskey charged players for laundering their uniforms. He promised an infielder named Bill Honeyfield a $1,000 bonus if Honeyfield stayed healthy enough to play in 100 games, then benched him for the remainder of the season when he got to 99. In 1919, seven members of the White Sox, with names that could almost have been supplied by Central Casting, Chick Gandil, Happy Felsch, Swede Risberg, Lefty Williams, Eddie Sicati, Fred McMullen, and the great Shoeless Joe Jackson, agreed to throw the World Series against the Cincinnati Reds for fairly modest payoffs. The Black Sox conspirators, as they were known, were not, by and large, terribly bright. Risberg had just a third-grade education and was a borderline psychotic. He threatened to kill anyone who blew the whistle on the fix and was deemed just about unbalanced enough to do so. Jackson had never been to school at all and couldn't read or write. Several of the conspirators seemed not quite to understand what was expected of them. Jackson batted .375 in the series and had a record 8 hits, one of them a surprise bunt in the 10th inning of a tied game that he beat out with great hustle. Gandil won a game with a walk-off hit. In the end, the White Sox did lose the series 5-3, but seemed to struggle to do so. One reason for this, it has been suggested, is that the Reds were in on a separate fix and were doing their utmost to lose too. Nearly every baseball insider, it seems, knew what was going on. When the scandal broke, the major league owners invited, in fact all but beseeched, Landis to become baseball's first commissioner. Landis agreed on the understanding that he'd be given dictatorial powers and a written undertaking from the owners that they would never question his judgments. He set up office in the People's Gas Building in Chicago behind a door that had a single word on it. Baseball. The seven conspirators, plus another player, Buck Weaver, who didn't take part in the fix but knew about it and didn't report it, were put on trial in the summer of 1921. A fact not often remembered is that the jury found all eight not guilty, then went out with them to celebrate in a restaurant. One reason the players were cleared was that it was not actually illegal to fix a baseball game, so they could only be charged with willfully defrauding the public and injuring Comiskey's business, and the jurors decided that that case was not proved. The point was academic, because Landis banned them all for life anyway. Landis at first kept his federal judgeship, even though it was illegal for him to do so. For entirely understandable reasons, judges were not permitted to receive money from private interests. Eventually, Landis was compelled to give up his role as judge, an outcome that may have affected history more than is appreciated, because Landis was also a vigorous defender of prohibition, a novel position to take in Chicago in the 1920s. He handed out prison sentences of up to 2 years to people found guilty of purveying even small amounts of liquor. On his very last day as a judge, in early 1922, he sentenced a small-time Chicago saloon keeper to 1 year in jail and a $1,000 fine for selling 2 glasses of whiskey. Had Landis stayed on the bench, Chicago might not have remained the world's most comfortable place to be a bootlegger. Whatever Kennesaw Mountain Landis did for baseball, he may actually, if inadvertently, have done even more for Al Capone. Chicago in 1927 was both the second largest city in America and the fourth largest in the world. Outside America, only London and Paris were grander. But it was also famous, in the words of an editorial in the Chicago Tribune, for moronic buffoonery, barbaric crime, triumphant hoodlumism, unchecked graft, and a dejected citizenship. What the Tribune editorialist didn't say, obviously couldn't say, was that a certain portion of that buffoonery resided with the paper's own proprietor, Robert Rutherford McCormick. McCormick was born in 1880 into a family that was rich and unhappy in roughly equal measure. Through his father, he was related to Cyrus McCormick, inventor of the mechanical reaper, which brought a lucrative connection to International Harvester. And on his mother's side, he stood heir to the Chicago Tribune. His mother was so disappointed that Robert was a boy that she dressed him as a girl and called him Roberta until he was old enough to go to school. Whether for this reason or some other, McCormick didn't discover sex until he was well into his 30s. Then he became something of a satyr, and, among other transgressions, stole his first wife from a cousin. He had a boyish enthusiasm for warfare, and was delighted beyond words to be made a colonel in the Illinois National Guard, without ever having done anything to merit it other than to exist as a rich person. For the rest of his life, he insisted on being addressed as colonel. When his wife died, he had her buried with full military honors, a distinction to which she was not remotely entitled or very probably desirous. When the First World War broke out, McCormick served briefly in France. His one battlefield experience was at Contigny, which so moved him that he made that the name of his estate at Wheaton, Illinois, upon his return to civilian life. With another cousin, Joseph Medill Patterson, McCormick ran the Chicago Tribune from 1910. Although Patterson was an avowed socialist, and McCormick was just an inch or so to the left of fascism, they worked surprisingly well together, and the paper prospered, doubling its circulation in their first decade of management. In 1919, the cousins launched the tabloid New York Daily News. Remarkably, for the first 6 years of its existence, they ran it from Chicago. Eventually, Patterson went off to New York to focus on the Daily News, leaving McCormick in sole charge of the Tribune. Under McCormick, the Tribune achieved its era of greatest importance. By 1927, its circulation was 815,000, almost double what it is today. The company owned paper mills, ships, dams, docks, some 7,000 square miles of forests, and one of the country's earliest and most successful radio stations, WGN, short for World's Greatest Newspaper. It also had interests in real estate and banks. As the years passed, McCormick became increasingly eccentric. When the president of the Lakeshore Bank, which he controlled, displeased him, McCormick demoted him to running a vegetable stand outside his estate. He insisted that the Tribune always refer to Henry Luce, whom he loathed, as Henry Luce, who was born in China but is not a Chinaman. He developed a private theory that that men at the University of Wisconsin wore lace underwear and dispatched a reporter to find out if that was true. Coincidentally, this was just at the time that Charles Lindbergh was a student there. For reasons never explained, McCormick kept Eastern time at his estate, but didn't tell guests, so first-time visitors often arrived at dinner to find the dishes being cleared away. In addition to Henry Luce, McCormick deeply detested Henry Ford, immigrants, and Prohibition. But above all else, he hated Chicago's mayor, William Hale Thompson. Thompson was an oaf from head to toe and ear to ear, but his supporters never held that against him. "The worst you can say about Bill is that he's stupid," remarked one cheerfully. Thompson was supported because he never got in the way of corruption or the making of money. Born 2 years before the Great Fire of Chicago in 1871, Thompson grew up rich. His father made a fortune buying property cheaply from distressed owners after the fire and selling it at great profit as Chicago regrew. Young Thompson grew into a strapping lad. He was 6'4" tall and so known to all as Big Bill, but not an especially promising one. He dropped out of school and went west, working as a ranch hand and cowboy. But in 1899, after the death of his father, he returned to Chicago and took over the family business. Despite a lack of brains or aptitude, in 1915 he was elected mayor, and for the next 8 years presided serenely as the city became the most resplendently corrupt and lawless in the nation. Chicago was to corruption what Pittsburgh was to steel or Hollywood to motion pictures. It refined and cultivated it and embraced it without embarrassment. When a mobster named Anthony D'Andrea was killed in 1921, 8,000 people attended the funeral. The cortege was 2.5 miles long. The honorary pallbearers included 21 judges, 9 lawyers, and the Illinois state prosecutor. Gangsters enjoyed almost total immunity in the city. When 3 men came to the home of an underworld figure named Patsy Lilordo and shot him dead on his own sofa, they left fingerprints all over the room. Mrs. Lilordo knew the men and said she was prepared to give evidence against them. Police investigated, but decided, with regret, that they couldn't find enough evidence to proceed. In 1927, the state of Illinois had never successfully prosecuted a single mobster for anything. It was a city where the chief of police, George Shippey, could shoot and kill an innocent man who was trying to deliver a package to his house because the man looked Jewish, and Shippey thought he might be delivering a bomb. The deceased, it turned out, was just an innocent delivery man trying to do his job. Shippey was not charged. Thompson, his work done, retired as mayor in 1923, but his admirers, fearful of the kinds of things Emory Buckner was doing in New York, padlockings and so on, persuaded Thompson to run again in 1927, just to be on the safe side. By Chicago standards, the election was peaceful. There were just 2 bombings, 2 shootings, 2 election officials beaten and kidnapped, and 12 declared cases of intimidation of voters. Al Capone donated $260,000 to Thompson's campaign. He, or someone in his camp, is believed to have coined the droll slogan, "Vote early and vote often." And it appears that many took him at his word. According to the official tally, slightly more than 1 million votes were cast in a city with almost exactly that number of registered voters. Thompson had run on a novel platform. He had vowed to repeal Prohibition, keep America out of the League of Nations, and end crime in Chicago. The first two he had no power to do. The third he had no intention of doing. He also claimed, for reasons not easily discerned, that King George V of Britain was planning to annex Chicago, and promised that if elected, he would find the king and punch him in the snoot. His first action on re-election was to set about removing all treasonous works from the city's schools and libraries. Thompson appointed a theater owner and former billboard changer named Sport Herman to purge the city's institutions of any works that were less than 100% American. Herman appointed a body called the Patriots League to decide which books were sufficiently objectionable to be discarded, but admitted, when pressed, that he had read none of the books that he was proposing to burn. It is entirely possible that he had never read a book of any kind, and further admitted that he couldn't remember the names of any of the people advising him. Just to make sure that no possible element of self-inflicted risibility was overlooked, Herman announced that the bonfire would be lit by the Cook County executioner. Remarkably, all this got a lot of support. William Randolph Hearst's Herald and Examiner backed Thompson's campaign and hoped that other cities would clear their library shelves too. The Ku Klux Klan likewise saluted the clear-out and suggested that the city next turn its attention to any books that were favorably inclined towards Jews or Catholics. The head of the Municipal Reference Library announced that he had independently destroyed all books and pamphlets in his care that struck him as dubious. "I now have an America First Library," he said proudly. In such a world as this, Al Capone looked sane and practically respectable. He liked to insist that he was really just a businessman. "I make my money by supplying a public demand," he said at a press conference in 1927, and it is notable that Al Capone held press conferences. 90% of the people of Cook County drink and gamble, and my offense has been to furnish them with those amusements. Whatever else they may say, my booze has been good, and my games have been on the square. In 1927, he headed an organization that turned over $100 million a year. He may have approached matters from a wayward angle, but Al Capone was one of America's great success stories. He was born Alphonse Capone in January 1899 in Brooklyn. His father was a conscientious citizen and never, as far as is known, broke the law. He was a barber and eventually owned his own shop, a proud achievement for a poor immigrant. He never learned English. Al was the Capone's fourth son and the first one born in America. His eldest brother, Vincenzo, ran away to the West in 1908 at the age of 16. The Capones got one letter from him the following year, from Kansas, then heard nothing more from him ever again. In fact, Vincenzo had become a prohibition agent known as Richard Two-Gun Hart. He had named himself after the cowboy star William S. Hart, and dressed like him, too, in outsized Stetson with a tin star on his breast and a pair of loaded holsters around his waist. In the summer of 1927, extraordinarily enough, he was in South Dakota and working as a personal bodyguard to President Coolidge. Young Al, needless to say, followed a rather different career path. Expelled from school for striking a teacher, she hit him first, he always carefully explained, he became a protege of a Brooklyn racketeer named Johnny Torrio. A mild, delicate person, Torrio was the man who put the organized into organized crime. He was adept at gaining control of particular trades or businesses. All the ice delivery men in a borough, say, would pay a commission to Torrio, and in return would be granted a monopoly in a particular district, allowing them to raise their prices. Anyone who challenged their monopoly was likely to find his office dynamited, his legs broken, his building condemned by the city, or any of a number of other undesirable outcomes. Torrio, at his peak, controlled 200 separate associations, from the Soda Dispensers and Table Girl Brotherhood to the Bread Cracker Yeast and Pie Wagon Drivers Union. Even shoeshine boys paid him $15 up front and $2 a month thereafter. In 1920, for reasons that have never been convincingly explained, Torrio decided to leave Brooklyn and start all over again in Chicago. As a first move, he knocked off a mobster there named Big Jim Colosimo, who in some accounts is described as Torrio's uncle, and in others simply as an associate, and took over his operations. Things went well for some time, but then territorial tensions arose. On a cold afternoon in January 1925, Torrio was helping his wife carry bags of shopping from their car into their house, when two men from a rival gang approached and shot him 5 times at close range. Torrio survived, but decided he had had enough. He turned all the Chicago operations over to Al Capone. And so began America's most famous era in lawlessness. The two most striking features of Capone's reign were how youthful he was and how short it was. Capone was just 25, Lindbergh's age at the time of his Paris flight, when he took over from Torrio, and his career as a top mobster really only lasted from the spring of 1925 to the end of 1927. As late as early 1926, newspapers in Chicago were giving Capone's name as Capone, or Caproni. A Chicago Tribune reporter in the summer of 1926 dubbed him Scarface, and it was then that the legends began. A reporter for Time magazine colorfully and imaginatively claimed that Capone had been branded on one swart cheek — Time really couldn't get enough of that word, swart — by the razor memento of the Neapolitan Camorra. In fact, Capone got his scars one evening at a Coney Island bar when, drunk, he leaned across to a girl and said, "Honey, you have a nice ass, and I mean that as a compliment." Unfortunately, the young woman was with her brother, who felt honor-bound to do something emotional, and he slashed Capone across the face with a knife, leaving him with 2 livid scars on his left cheek and a fainter one along the neck. Capone was always self-conscious about the scars and did all he could to disguise them, including coating his face in talcum powder. Capone was no doubt capable of violence, but it is perhaps worth noting that the well-remembered scene in which he beats to death 2 dinner guests with a baseball bat was entirely made up. It appeared in a 1975 book called The Legacy of Al Capone by a writer named George Murray. In half a century, no one else had ever mentioned it. And beating guests to death at a dinner table is not something other guests would forget to mention. Capone has also many times been credited with the line, "You can get a lot farther with a smile and a gun than you can with just a smile." But it appears he probably never said that either. Chicago in the 1920s was not really as violent as reputation has it. With 13.3 murders per 100,000 population, it was indubitably more homicidal than New York with 6.1, Los Angeles with 4.7, or Boston with just 3.9. But it was less dangerous than Detroit at 16.8, or almost any city in the South. New Orleans had a murder rate of 25.9 per 100,000, while Little Rock's was 37.9, Miami's 40, Atlanta's 43.4, Charlotte's 55.5, and Memphis was miles ahead of everyone with a truly whopping rate of 69.3. The average in America today, you may be surprised and comforted to hear, is 6 per 100,000. One thing Chicago did have was a special attachment among its gangsters for the Thompson submachine gun, or Tommy gun as it was more affectionately known. The gun was named after General John Taliaferro Thompson, director of U.S. arsenals, who spent much of the First World War developing it. His idea was to make a portable machine gun light enough to be carried by a single soldier. Thompson's gun was wondrously lethal. It could fire up to 1,000 rounds a minute and drill holes through armored vehicles. In a demonstration, it cut through 1/4-inch steel plate and felled a tree almost 2 feet thick. Unfortunately, by the time Thompson had the gun ready for production, the war was over, and the army didn't want it. Police forces didn't want it either, because it was so lively that it was impossible to aim accurately. Fire from a Thompson was all but randomly distributed, which made it ideal for hoodlums, and made hoodlums very scary people once they started pulling the trigger. Illinois imposed no restrictions on the sale of Tommy guns, so they were available to the general public in hardware stores, sporting goods stores, and even drug stores. The wonder is that the death tolls in Chicago weren't higher. What Chicago also had in unusual abundance throughout Prohibition was beer. Most cities didn't. Beer required corruption on an epic scale. You can't hide a brewery. So to produce and distribute beer without attracting legal inquiries, required the disbursement of a great deal of hush money, and there was hardly a uniformed official in the city who didn't share in the benefits. A steady stream of police and officials visited Capone's headquarters at the Metropole Hotel each day to pick up their payoffs and instructions. Capone's payroll to the police alone was nearly $600,000 a week. The police force of Chicago became, in effect, his private army. Goodness knows what Kennesaw Mountain Landis would have made of that if he had been left in his position as a federal judge. Prohibition may be the greatest gift any government ever gave its citizens. A barrel of beer cost $4 to make and sold for $55. A case of spirituous liquor cost $20 to produce and earned $90, and all this without taxes. By 1927, Capone's organization, which, interestingly, had no name, had estimated receipts of $105 million. The scale of his operations unquestionably makes him one of the most successful businessmen in American history. Many people, it seems, were very happy to look at it that way. When students at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, named for Robert McCormick's grandfather, were asked in 1927 to name the 10 most outstanding people in the world, they chose Charles Lindbergh, Richard Byrd, Benito Mussolini, Henry Ford, Herbert Hoover, Albert Einstein, Mahatma Gandhi, George Bernard Shaw, the golfer Bobby Jones, and Al Capone. For Capone, 1927 was an exceptionally good year. Profits were flowing in, Chicago's gangs were mostly at peace, and Capone increasingly found himself a person of importance. When newspaper delivery men threatened a crippling strike in Chicago, it was to Capone, not Big Bill Thompson, that the proprietors turned for help. Capone got the strike called off and was invited to a meeting of the owners, chaired by Robert McCormick, so that they could express their gratitude. "McCormick wanted to pay me afterward," Capone said later, "but I told him to give the money to a hospital." McCormick's version of the story was rather different. "I arrived late at a publisher's meeting," he recorded briskly in a memoir. "Capone walked in with some of his hoodlums. I threw him out." Whatever in fact transpired, there was no strike, and the newspapers of Chicago forever after went easy on Capone. As the summer of 1927 wound to an end, Al Capone was the world's favorite gangster. In a couple of weeks, 150,000 people would pack into Soldier Field in Chicago to watch the Dempsey-Tunney rematch. The place would be full of celebrities, but it would be Al Capone that everyone in the stadium would crane to see. At the age of 28, he appeared to be on top of the world. In fact, time was about to run out for him. Within 6 months, he would be gone from Chicago, and his world would be crumbling around him. Chapter 30. Lou Gehrig, in his quiet, methodical, all but invisible way, was having a fantastic year. As the second week of September began, he had 45 home runs, 161 runs batted in, and a .389 batting average. As his biographer Jonathan Eig notes in Luckiest Man, Gehrig could have stopped there, with almost a month of the season still to play, and had one of the best seasons ever. In fact, he did essentially stop there. His mother was unwell with a goiter and needed surgery. Gehrig was beside himself with anxiety. "I'm so worried about Mom that I can't see straight," he confided to a teammate. All his thoughts were on Mom, the sports writer Fred Lieb wrote later. As soon as he finished the game, he would rush to the hospital and stay with her until her bedtime. Gehrig hit just 2 more home runs the rest of the season. His heart wasn't in the game. All he could think about was his beloved Mama. Babe Ruth, meanwhile, began knocking balls out of parks as if hitting tee shots at a driving range. Between September 2nd and 29th, he hit 17 home runs. No one had ever done anything like that in a single month. The Yankees seemed incapable of doing anything wrong. On September 10th, they beat St. Louis for the 21st time in a row, the most consecutive victories by one team over another during a single season. On September 16th, Wilsie Moore, who was such a bad batter that players would come out of the locker room and vendors would pause in their transactions to watch the extraordinary sight of him flailing at empty air with a piece of wood, miraculously connected with the ball and sent it over the right field wall for a home run, an event that nearly gave Babe Ruth a heart attack. On the mound, Moore scattered 7 hits to push his record to 18 wins and 7 losses as the Yanks beat the White Sox 7-2. In the midst of this, almost unnoticed, the Yankees clinched the pennant. They had been in first place every day of the season, the first time that had ever happened. Their position was so commanding that they could lose all 15 of their remaining games, and the second-place Philadelphia Athletics could win all 17 of theirs, and the Yankees would still come out on top. In point of fact, the Yankees won 12 of their last 15 games, even though they didn't need to. They couldn't help themselves. Ruth was majestically imperturbable. On September 16th, he was called into court in Manhattan, charged with the alarming crime of punching a cripple. The reputed victim, Bernard Niemeyer, claimed that on the evening of July 4th, he had been walking near the Ansonia Hotel when a man, accompanied by 2 women, accused him of making an inappropriate remark and punched him hard in the face. Niemeyer said he didn't recognize his assailant, but was told by onlookers that it was Babe Ruth. Ruth, in his defense, said that he had been having dinner with friends at the time and produced 2 witnesses in corroboration. In court, Niemeyer seemed to be a little crazy. The Times reported that he frequently rose excitedly to his feet, waving a book of notes which he added to from time to time as the hearing proceeded. He was often cautioned by the clerk of the court not to talk so loudly. The judge dismissed the case to general applause. Ruth signed a bunch of autographs, then went to the ballpark and hit a home run, his 53rd. 2 days later, in a doubleheader against the White Sox, he socked his 54th, a 2-run shot in the 5th inning. 3 days after that, on September 21st, Ruth came to the plate in the bottom of the 9th inning against Detroit. The bases were empty, and the Tigers were up 6-0, so Sam Gibson, the Tigers' pitcher, didn't need to throw him anything good, and dutifully endeavored not to. Ruth caught one anyway, and hefted it deep into the right field stands for his 55th homer. A new record was beginning to seem entirely possible. The next day, Ruth hit one of his most splendid home runs of the season. In the bottom of the 9th inning, with Mark Koenig on third and the Yankees trailing 7-6, Ruth came to the plate and lofted his 56th home run high into the right field bleachers for a walk-off 8-7 victory. As Ruth trotted around the bases, carrying his bat with him, as he often did, to make sure nobody ran off with it, a boy of about 10 rushed in from right field and joined him on the base paths. The boy grabbed onto the bat with both hands and was essentially carried around the bases and into the dugout, where Ruth quickly vanished down the runway, pursued by yet more jubilant fans. The game was the Yankees' 105th victory of the season, tying the American League record for season victories. Beyond Yankee Stadium, the world hardly noticed. Halfway across the continent in Chicago, something much more exciting was about to happen. It was the Dempsey-Tunney fight. Chicago was even more abuzz than it had been for Lindbergh's recent visit. People poured into the city in numbers never before seen. It was impossible to find a hotel bed hard enough to get a seat in a restaurant. Chartered trains streamed in from every point of the compass, from Akron, Pittsburgh, Atlanta, the distant West. In 3 days, more than 100 extra trains arrived in the city. Scheduled trains were made longer, in some cases much longer. The 20th Century Limited that pulled in on fight day was 3 times its normal length. Among the arriving multitudes were Al Jolson, Charlie Chaplin, Douglas Fairbanks, Harold Lloyd, Florence Ziegfeld, Gloria Swanson, Walter Chrysler, Ty Cobb, 9 U.S. senators, 10 state governors, mayors beyond counting, and business potentates from all over. David Sarnoff was there to make sure the radio hookups were all in order. The Marquess of Douglas and Clydesdale, a British adventurer who would shortly become the first man to fly over Mount Everest, attended as the guest of Jean Tunney, as did the British writer Somerset Maugham. Popular sentiment was overwhelmingly with Dempsey. Tunney had all the makings of a hero. He was clean-living, intelligent, polite, reasonably good-looking, but, like Lou Gehrig, he lacked the chemistry that stirred affection. He had grown up poor in Greenwich Village, the son of Irish immigrants, and weighed just 140 pounds when he took up boxing professionally. Even when he had built himself up to 190 pounds, he lacked power. He made up for it through deft feinting and jabbing. As Tunney explained it, Dempsey was a fighter, but he was a boxer, something much more scientific. He won his bouts by outthinking his opponents and wearing them down. The strategy nearly always worked. In 66 professional bouts, Tunney was beaten just once, by Harry Greb in 1922. No one had ever knocked him off his feet. Tunney promoted himself as an intellectual and a gentleman. He didn't drink or swear and refused to advertise cigarettes, but he made a lot of money endorsing other things, cars, hats, shoes, pajamas, and walking sticks, among much else. He had an unfortunate tendency to pomposity. He liked to carry a book around with him. When asked what it was, he would reply casually, "Oh, just a copy of the Rubaiyat that I am never without." This was largely why most people couldn't stand him. The typical fight fan, as Paul Gallico of the Daily News put it, wanted to see the book-reading snob socked back to Shakespeare. One serious concern with staging the fight in Chicago was the city's reputation for corruption. Al Capone had long been a Dempsey admirer. He hated Tunney's refined mannerisms. A fucking pansy was how he characterized him. Capone let word get out that he would make sure Dempsey didn't lose this time. Dempsey was horrified to learn this and wrote to Capone pleading with him not to interfere. "If I beat Tunney, or Tunney beats me in true sportsmanship, it will prove who really deserves to be champion," Dempsey explained. The next day, he received 300 roses and an unsigned card saying, "To the Dempseys in the name of sportsmanship." Capone reportedly bet $50,000 on Dempsey to win and bought 100 of the best seats in the stadium at $40 a seat. On fight day, Tunney and Dempsey both jogged 5 miles, then relaxed. Tunney passed the time examining rare manuscripts in a library with his new pal Somerset Maugham. Dempsey's pastimes were not noted, but presumably were a little less intellectually ambitious. By early evening, Soldier Field was steadily filling and the atmosphere was growing electric. People spent most of the time before the fight picking out celebrities at ringside. Though people in the most distant seats, it must be said, could barely see the ring, never mind those gathered around it. Some seats were over 700 feet from the action. The most enlivening pre-fight moment was when Al Capone arrived, in overcoat and fedora, encircled, as always, by a protective ring of burly men. "Nothing smaller than a field piece could penetrate his double-walled fortress of meat," wrote the New Yorker later. Accompanying Capone, a special guest, was Damon Runyon. The crowd was put at 150,000, enough to fill Yankee Stadium twice over. 6,000 ushers attended to the throngs. Each wore an armband saying, "Tunney Dempsey Boxing Exhibition," a touch of gentility insisted on by Tunney. Never before had so many sports fans packed into a single space. In the center of it all, a small bright opening in an ocean of heads and enshrouding darkness, was the ring. Bathed in the light of 44 1,000-watt lamps, the ring was 20 feet to a side, the largest size allowed, which gave Tunney more room to escape. A crucial feature of the Dempsey-Firpo fight had been that Dempsey was able to stand over Firpo and clobber him anew each time Firpo tried to haul himself to his feet. It was this that led the Tunney camp to insist on the rule of retiring to a neutral corner after a knockdown, a consideration that would give boxing its greatest moment of controversy before the night was out. The National Broadcasting Company linked 82 stations to form a national broadcast. More people listened to the fight that night than had witnessed any other event in history. For Lindbergh's homecoming in June, the audience had been 30 million. This time, it would be 50 million. As ever, Graham McNamee's was the warm voice that nearly half the nation turned to. The most striking feature of the fight was its lateness. The scheduled starting time was 9:45 p.m. in Chicago, 10:45 p.m. on the East Coast, and proceedings were running about 15 minutes late when the two robed competitors finally emerged, to a stupendous and appreciative roar from the crowd, and climbed into the intensely bright ring. Both fighters looked calm and prepared. The referee, Dave Barry, gave the customary lecture at the center of the ring. The men retired to their corners, a bell clanged, and the most eagerly anticipated fight in America to that time, possibly ever, began. Dempsey came out swinging and hit so hard that McNamee said he could see the ring trembling. But Tunney dodged and danced expertly, and Dempsey's blows mostly fell harmlessly against his arms. Tunney, at the same time, began picking Dempsey to pieces, jabbing and parrying, then dancing away. The strategy had a devastating cumulative effect. Dempsey's face became more and more swollen with each passing round, eventually, it seemed, with each passing blow. Cuts opened above his eyes, and he bled from the mouth. But still he marched on, tirelessly, relentlessly, savagely, viciously, desperately, in the words of New York Times reporter James P. Dawson. Tunney was cruising to victory when, in the seventh round, Dempsey stopped him in his tracks and brought 150,000 people to their feet with a sudden, violent flurry of punches that left Tunney sitting on the canvas in a helpless daze, his left arm resting on a rope. He was almost certainly no more than a punch or two away from oblivion. "I am free to say I found the canvas a pretty comfortable place just then," Tunney joked to reporters afterwards, but he was in serious trouble, and 50 million people in America knew it. At least 10 radio listeners, it was later reported, dropped dead from heart attacks during the seventh round, though surely any such figure was drawn from thin air. Dempsey, his blood up, failed to withdraw immediately to a neutral corner, as required, but hovered, waiting to clobber Tunney when he rose again. The referee, Barry, had to shoo him back to neutral territory before starting the count. This gave Tunney a few precious extra moments to recover. How many exactly has been a matter of intense debate ever since, but it was something in the region of 5 or 6 seconds. At the count of 9, Tunney clambered back to his feet and, with surprising lightness, managed to dance his way out of further trouble. In fact, he had little idea what was going on. "I was oblivious, and had to be told later on what happened," he admitted years later. Dempsey had blown his chance. The exertion left the former champ exhausted. In the next round, Tunney floored him with a sudden sharp hook of his own. Dempsey bounded back up, but he seemed to have little left. Tunney dominated easily thereafter and won on a unanimous decision. Dempsey's supporters have always felt that their hero was cheated, as did Dempsey himself. "Intentionally or otherwise, I was robbed of the championship," he told reporters in his dressing room immediately after the fight. "I am not an alibi artist, but I know down in my soul that I knocked Tunney out tonight, and what's more, chased him all around the ring and should have won on points at least." According to Roger Kahn, in his 1999 biography of Dempsey, A Flame of Pure Fire, the referee didn't enforce the neutral corner rule when Dempsey went down. Kahn said he was consumed by outrage when he first reviewed footage of the two key moments of the fight. Two knockdowns, one round apart, and two different sets of rules. "The explanation, I believe, is not complicated. In my tape of Chicago 1927, I am looking at a crooked referee," Kahn wrote. In fact, a viewing of the footage, now available to everyone with access to the Internet, is not nearly so clear-cut. When Tunney fell in the seventh round, Barry pushed Dempsey out of the way, clearly ordering him back to his corner, then turned and began the count immediately while Dempsey was still withdrawing. Barry could hardly have acted more quickly or decisively. In the following round, when Dempsey fell, Barry didn't send Tunney to a neutral corner because there wasn't time to. Dempsey jumped up immediately, like someone rebounding off a trampoline, and began swinging again before the referee could step forward or even raise his arm. The long count was unfortunate, but no one was to blame for it more than Jack Dempsey. Tunney chose to look at the bigger picture. "We have fought 20 rounds, and I think I beat him in 19 of them," he told reporters. Tunney earned $990,000 for the fight, which someone calculated included $7,700 for time spent horizontal during the long count. Dempsey made just under $450,000. Tunney was eager for yet another rematch, but Dempsey declined. He never fought again. Tunney had just one more fight himself. He shunned the obvious challenger, Jack Sharkey, and instead fought a New Zealander named Tom Heaney at Yankee Stadium. Tunney won in 11 rounds and made $500,000 for his effort. But what was most notable about the fight was that only half the tickets were sold. Boxing without Dempsey was not the draw it had been. The promoters lost over $150,000. In early September, from South America, there came an intriguing story. A French engineer named Roger Courtville, while making a journey by car from Rio de Janeiro to Lima, the first coast-to-coast crossing of South America by motorized vehicle, in itself an extraordinary story, announced that en route along a lonely track in Mato Grosso State, he had come upon the missing English explorer Percy Fawcett, last seen hunting for the fabled lost city of Z in the jungles beyond Fordlandia. At the time of their encounter, Courtville didn't realize who Fawcett was, so didn't report his discovery. In accounts he wrote later for the New York Times, Courtville said that he was brought up short by the sight of a gray-haired white man, about 60 years old, sitting by a rutted track in the middle of nowhere. He was wearing shorts, a khaki shirt, and old thick-soled shoes, which were tied to his stockingless feet by fibers of swamp plants, Courtville reported. His hands were shaking with fever. Courtville particularly noted that the man's bare legs were swarming with mosquitoes. Courtville spoke to him in Portuguese, but got no reply, then tried English. He asked the man why he allowed the mosquitoes to browse so freely on his legs. "They're hungry, the poor devils," the man replied flatly in an English accent. That, remarkably, was the extent of their conversation. The stranger, after the manner of Englishmen, was unresponsive and disinclined to talk about himself and his affairs, Courtville went on. So, amazingly, Courtville got back in his car without making any effort to determine the man's identity, render assistance, or even to ask what he was doing there. He just drove on and casually reported the encounter to an official in Lima when he got there some months later. The official got very excited because Fawcett was the most famous missing man in South America. As it turned out, the man Courtville encountered could not have been Fawcett. For one thing, Fawcett was bald, and this man had long hair. So who he was and how he had gotten there were great mysteries. No one knew of any other Englishman who had gone into the jungle and not come out again. Courtville's discovery, even though it wasn't Fawcett, stirred interest in Fawcett anew. A British-American adventurer named George Millard Dyett announced plans to lead a search party into the 50,000 square miles of tangled wilderness in which Fawcett might reasonably be supposed to be. Supported by 10 mules, 64 bullocks, and a small army of guides and porters, Dyett spent months hacking his way into the interior and nearly died himself, but didn't find Fawcett or Courtville's mysterious Englishman or anyone else who wasn't known to be there already. Then two more people, a Swiss man and a reporter from United Press International, embarked on a separate expedition, but were never heard from again at all. From England, Fawcett's wife said people should stop their searching. She told reporters that she was in touch with her husband telepathically and that he was fine and would come out when he was ready. He never did. On September 2nd, en route to Cheyenne, Wyoming, Charles Lindbergh flew over Rapid City High School and the State Game Lodge where the Coolidges had made their home for the summer. President Coolidge came out and waved a handkerchief. Lindbergh dropped special messages at both places. The one at the game lodge was never found. Seeing how tired Lindbergh had become, those responsible for his tour instituted a rule that he would provide no more than 4.5 hours of personal appearances a day, 2.5 hours of parades and speeches by day, and 2 hours of banqueting at night. Everything would have to be compressed to fit into that timetable. Newspapers continued to report his progress around the country, but with more of a sense of duty than of enthusiasm, and the stories nearly always now appeared on inside pages. Only occasionally did something mildly out of the ordinary happen. In Abilene, Texas, Lindbergh arrived to find that the organizers had fitted his parade vehicle with a throne. Embarrassed at such a display of grandeur, Lindbergh refused to sit in it, and it had to be removed. That was about as interesting as Lindbergh's tour got now. With the Dempsey-Tunney fight concluded, sports fans turned their attention back to baseball and the question of whether Babe Ruth could break his home run record. It was getting awfully close. Ruth went 2 games on September 24th and 25th without a homer, which left him 4 short of the record with just 4 games to play. On the first of those 4 games, on September 27th, Ruth got his 57th in style by hitting a grand slam off Lefty Grove of Philadelphia, one of only 6 home runs Grove gave up all season. Ruth didn't hit grand slams often. This was his first of the season and only the 6th of his career. The Yankees had a day off on September 28th, and the rest clearly did Ruth good, for in his first at-bat the next day, in the start of a 3-game series against the Washington Senators, he hit his 58th home run off Horace Hod Lisenby, a rookie who was having a great year, the only good one he would ever have. Like Lefty Grove, Lisenby gave up just 6 home runs all season. 2 of them were by Ruth. Ruth now needed just 1 more to tie his record. In the bottom of the 5th inning, Ruth came to the plate with the bases loaded and 2 out. Senators manager Bucky Harris signaled to the bullpen to send in a right-hander named Paul Hopkins. Hopkins was an unexpected choice, and no doubt caused many a spectator to turn to the nearest person with a scorecard for enlightenment. Hopkins had just graduated from Colgate University and had never pitched in the major leagues before. Now he was about to make his debut in Yankee Stadium against Babe Ruth with the bases loaded and Ruth trying to tie his own record for most home runs in a season. Pitching carefully, as you might expect, Hopkins worked the count to 3 balls and 2 strikes, then tried to sneak a slow curve past Ruth. It was an outstanding pitch. It was so slow, Hopkins recalled for Sports Illustrated 70 years later, at the age of 94, that Ruth started to swing and then hesitated, hitched on it, and brought the bat back. And then he swung, breaking his wrists as he came through it. What a great eye he had! He hit it at the right second, put everything behind it. I can still hear the crack of the bat. I can still see the swing. It was Ruth's 59th home run, tying a record that less than a month before had seemed hopelessly out of reach. The ball floated over the head of the right fielder, 37-year-old Sam Rice, who is largely forgotten now, but was one of the great players of his day, and also one of the most mysterious, for he had come to Major League Baseball seemingly from out of nowhere. 15 years earlier, Rice had been a promising youngster in his first season in professional baseball with a minor league team in Galesburg, Illinois. While he was away for the summer, his wife moved with their 2 small children onto his parents' farm near Donovan, Indiana. In late April, a tornado struck near Donovan, killing 75 people. Among the victims were Rice's wife, children, mother, and 2 sisters. Rice's father, himself seriously injured, was found wandering in shock with one of the dead children in his arms. He died 9 days later in the hospital. So, at a stroke, Rice lost his entire family. Dazed with grief, Rice drifted around America working at odd jobs. Eventually, he enlisted in the Navy. While playing for a Navy team, his remarkable talents became apparent. Clark Griffith, owner of the Washington Senators, somehow heard of this, invited him for a trial, and was impressed enough to sign him. Rice joined the Senators and in his 30s became one of the finest players in baseball. No one anywhere knew of his personal tragedy. It didn't become public until 1963, when he was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. After Ruth's homer, Hopkins struck out Lou Gehrig to end the inning, then retired to the bench and burst into tears. It was one of just 11 major league appearances Hopkins ever made. He missed the whole of the 1928 season with an injury and retired with a record of no wins and one loss after the 1929 season. He returned to his home state of Connecticut, became a successful banker, and lived to be 99. The last day of September was sultry in New York. The temperature was in the low 80s and the air muggy when, in the next-to-last game of the season, Ruth came to the plate in the bottom of the eighth inning against Tom Zachary, a 31-year-old left-hander from a tobacco farm in North Carolina. Though a pious Quaker, Zachary was not without guile. One of his tricks was to cover the pitching rubber with dirt so that he could move closer to home plate, sometimes by as much as 2 feet, it has been claimed. In 1927, he was in his 10th season. He gave up just 6 home runs all year. 3 of them were to Ruth. It was Ruth's 4th trip of the day to the plate. He had walked once and singled twice and had come nowhere near a home run. The score was tied 2-2. There was one out and one man on, Mark Koenig, who had tripled. Everybody knew he was out for the record, so he wasn't going to get anything good from me, Zachary told a reporter in 1961. Zachary wound up, eyed the runner, then uncorked a sizzling fastball. It went for a called strike. Zachary wound up and threw again. This pitch went high and away, and Ruth took it for a ball. For his 3rd pitch, Zachary threw a curve. As good as I had, he recalled. Ruth hit the ball with what was effectively a golf swing, lofting it high into the air in the direction of the right field foul pole. The 8,000 fans in Yankee Stadium watched in silence as the ball climbed to a towering height, then fell for ages and dropped into the bleachers just inches fair. Zachary threw down his glove in frustration. The crowd roared with pleasure. Ruth trotted around the bases with his curiously clipped and delicate gait, like someone trying to tiptoe at speed, then stepped out of the dugout to acknowledge the applause with a succession of snappy military salutes. Ruth was responsible for all 4 runs that day. The Times the next day referred to the score as Ruth 4, Senators 2. A little-known fact was that the game in which Babe Ruth hit his 60th home run was also the last game in the majors for Walter Johnson, the greatest pitcher of the age. No one threw harder. Jimmy Dykes, then of the Athletics, recalled in later years how as a rookie he was sent to the plate against Johnson and never even saw Johnson's first 2 pitches. He just heard them hit the catcher's mitt. After the 3rd pitch, the umpire told him to take first base. Why? Asked Dykes. You've been hit, explained the umpire. Are you sure? Asked Dykes. The umpire told him to check his hat. Dykes reached up and discovered that the cap was facing sideways from where Johnson's last pitch had spun the bill. He dropped his bat and hurried gratefully to first base. In 21 years as a pitcher, Johnson gave up only 97 home runs. When Ruth hit one off him in 1920, it was the first home run Johnson had yielded in almost 2 years. In 1927, Johnson broke his leg in spring training when hit by a line drive and never fully recovered. Now, with his 40th birthday approaching, he decided it was time to retire. In the top of the 9th inning, in his last appearance in professional baseball, he was sent in to pinch hit for Zachary. He hit a fly ball to right field. It was caught by Ruth to end the game, Johnson's career, and an important part of a glorious era. In the clubhouse afterwards, Ruth was naturally exultant over his 60th homer. Let's see some son of a bitch try and top that one, he kept saying. The general reaction among his teammates was congratulatory and warm, but in retrospect surprisingly muted. There wasn't the excitement you'd imagine Pete Sheehy, the team equipment manager, recalled many years later. No one expected Ruth to stop at 60. It was assumed that he would hit at least one more the next day, and possibly reach even greater heights in years to come. Ruth, after all, had been the first to hit 30, 40, 50, and 60 homers. Who knew that he wouldn't hit 70 in 1928? In fact, neither he nor anyone else would hit so many again for a very long time. In his last game of the season, Ruth, rather anticlimactically, went 0-for-3 with a walk. In his last at-bat, he struck out. Lou Gehrig, however, did hit a home run, his 47th of the season. That might seem a disappointing number after his earlier pace, so it is worth remembering that it was more than any other player had ever hit, apart from Ruth. In banging out 60 home runs, Ruth out-homered all major league teams, except the Cardinals, Cubs, and Giants. He hit home runs in every park in the American League and hit more on the road than at home. The tally was 32 on the road to 28 at home. He homered off 33 different pitchers. At least two of his home runs were the longest ever seen in the parks in which they were hit. Ruth hit a home run once every 11.8 times at bat. He had at least six home runs against every team in the American League. He did all this and still batted 356 and scored 158 runs, had 164 runs batted in, 138 walks, and even had 7 stolen bases and 14 sacrificed bunts. It would be hard to imagine a more extraordinary year. Ruth and Gehrig between them came first and second in home runs, runs batted in, slugging percentage, runs scored, total bases, extra base hits, and bases on balls. Combs and Gehrig were first and second in total hits and triples. Four players, Ruth, Gehrig, Lazeri, and Musil, each had more than 100 runs batted in. Combs was also third in runs scored and total bases, and Lazeri was third in home runs. As a team, the Yankees had the American League's highest team batting average and lowest earned run average. Their 911 runs were more than any American League team had ever scored in a season before. Their 110 victories were a league record, too. They averaged 6.3 runs per game and almost 11 hits. Just one player was ejected from a game all season, and the team had no fights with other teams. Baseball has never fielded a more complete, dominant, and disciplined team. Babe Ruth's home run record stood until 1961, when Roger Maris, also of the Yankees, hit 61, though Maris had the advantage of a longer season, which gave him 10 more games and 50 more at-bats than Ruth in 1927. In the 1990s, many baseball players suddenly became immensely strong. Some evolved whole new body shapes and began to smack home runs in quantities that made a mockery of Ruth's and Maris's numbers. It turned out that a great many of this new generation of ballplayers, something in the region of 5-7%, according to random drug tests introduced very belatedly in 2003, were taking anabolic steroids. The use of drugs as an aid to hitting is far beyond the scope of this book. So let us just note in passing that even with the benefit of steroids, most modern players still couldn't hit as many home runs as Babe Ruth hit on hot dogs.